I'll have to say at the very beginning that I feel exactly the same way as Kevin does. I've been anxiously waiting for 2 years for Kevin's speech to be over with also. No, really, primarily because I'm next, and that just means it's closer to mine being over with, too. I appreciate the invitation. What an awesome topic this is, and I couldn't feel any more insignificant and unworthy to talk about God's holiness. But that falls my lot, and so hopefully we can share some things together. I'm going to look at several things about holiness, look especially about how holiness is such an important part of the theme of the book of Leviticus. And then I'm going to have some things to say at the end as well. But I appreciate the invitation. And I'll be using the outline some, not sticking to the outline totally. Leviticus is a book, and I don't know where you stand in terms of your study of the Scriptures, but Leviticus is a book that I have come to late in life, unfortunately. Leviticus has been a part of my Old Testament that I call the White Pages. Very, you know, and by that I just mean that obviously down through the years I haven't spent very much time studying the book of Leviticus. It seemed to me as though there wasn't much in the book of Leviticus, and I was wrong about that, but it seemed to me as though there wasn't much in the book of Leviticus for me. And so Leviticus is considered to be boring by many. I think it was to me. Detailed sacrifices, long lists of laws. I appreciate very much the work that Kevin did in documenting those and sorting all of that out for us in his outline. I'm anxious to go back and look at that material again and study it in more detail later on. It neglected in our daily Bible reading, much like large portions of 1st and 2nd Chronicles. If you're doing a daily Bible reading schedule, very often Leviticus is one of those books you want to kind of move through pretty quickly so you can get to the more interesting stories in the book of Numbers. Clearly, Leviticus is in the Scriptures for a reason. There is a purpose for the book of Leviticus being there. It's part of the Scriptures that give us comfort and hope. And I was especially intrigued, and I would say if you don't have yet, my guess is probably most of you do, but if you haven't come in contact yet with Wenham's commentary on Leviticus in the Old Testament, it is a book that you need to get. In the introduction, this is the very first line. Several years ago, Leon was holding a meeting for us when I was preaching in Jackson, Tennessee, and he said this in a sermon. And Leon is not Wenham, so I didn't believe it. But sure enough, Wenham contends that Leviticus used to be the first book that Jewish children studied in the synagogue. That is such an odd statement. It's not the first book that we introduce our children to, is it? We introduce our children to Genesis, the stories of beginnings. We don't start them with Leviticus. So I've thought about this a lot. Why would Leviticus have been the first book? And this is the conclusion that I've come to, and this is just my opinion about it. But after doing a lot more study myself on the book of Leviticus in the last probably 7 or 8 years, I really suspect that the thinking behind this was that maybe no book in the Bible, certainly no book in the Pentateuch, presents God's holiness in any clearer way than the book of Leviticus does. And so the thinking perhaps in the minds of the Jewish parents was this: the first thing we'll do is we'll teach our children that God is holy, and we'll teach them what that means, and we'll teach them that God wants us to be holy. And then once you've established that base with your children, now go back and tell them the stories of the book of Genesis, all of which will make considerably more sense if they're understood in the context of the holiness of God and what God expects from his people. And so, obviously, Leviticus is an important book. It's not just a book of laws about the work of the priests. Obviously, considerably broader than that. This is a very lame attempt at humor. This is my effort to construct the book of Leviticus in outline form in a chiism. Some of you will understand that, and some of you won't. But anyway, most of the book of, forget that, most of the book of Leviticus deals with laws, laws of offerings, laws of priests, laws of purity, the Day of Atonement right in the middle of the book, laws of holiness, priests, appointed times, penalties, and vows. And what I would suggest to you is all of that deals with the subject of holiness. All of that relates to or is tied to the theme of the book, the main theme of the book, which is holiness. Just very quickly, you know, just for information, I've used this, I've preached some of this in other lessons, but the author of this is Moses. The giving of this material was during the period of time when Israel was camped around the base of Mount Sinai, and the theme is holy living. The largest percentage of the times when the word holy is used in the Old Testament are found in the book of Leviticus. The word holy, in the English Standard Version, the word holy appears 92 times in the book. That's a considerable amount of usage in the book of Leviticus. And so, be holy. You shall be holy, for God is holy. I need to define the term. And the only way I can define terms like this, I don't have the ability, don't have the training, which is, I'm not boasting about that. It's a little embarrassing that I don't know more about the original languages than I do. So I have to rely on what other people say. If you look at the Hebrew word in the Old Testament, I'm not going to even try to pronounce that. But possessing the original idea of separation or withdrawal, Brown, Driver, Briggs, the Hebrew word has the core meaning of to be set apart, apartness, or to be separate. And please understand when I'm giving you these definitions, when you look at these sources, when you look at these authorities, there's a lot more to it than what I'm going to show. But the theological word book of the Old Testament says the meaning to separate is favored by many scholars. But the fact that this word rarely, if ever, occurs in the secular sense makes any positive conclusion in this regard difficult because of the limited evidence on which to base philological comparison. And so the judgment is that to separate, or at least their conclusion is that to separate is what is favored by many scholars. And so, you know, what I'm going to do, and I'll do this with the Greek here in just a second too, but just to kind of summarize, the noun holy should be understood as something, if something is holy, it is separate or set apart or devoted, and specifically what in our context we're talking about something being devoted to God for a specific purpose. The verb to make holy or to be holy means to separate something for a particular purpose. The adjective holy is something that has been set apart or separated for a particular purpose. The practical, tangible concept of separation, then, is at the core of the Hebrew word. In other words, in my judgment, if we could boil everything that the scholars say about holiness, what does it mean to be holy? And one of the reasons why I think this is important, and I talk about this a little bit in the beginning of the outline, is that holy, the English word holy is kind of a nebulous word. The English word holy paints all kinds of different pictures in people's minds. And when you look at the English definitions of the word holy, there's a lot of confusion. The word holy is very often mistaken for the word pious, I think. But the Hebrew word didn't carry that connotation. The Hebrew word talked about something that was set apart or set aside for a specific purpose, consecrated for a specific purpose. And again, in the book of Leviticus, we're talking about people and things that were set aside specifically for the purpose of God. You see the same thing with the Greek word in the New Testament. And it's impressive how often, in the 27 books of the New Testament, it's impressive how often this word or some form of it appears 275 times. This word or one of its cognates appears in the New Testament. This is Thayer's first definition. From hagos, religious awe, reverence, to venerate, revere, especially the gods or parents. Rare, Thayer says, in secular authors, very frequent in the sacred writings. And then the same word is our Hebrew word in the Old Testament. But this is Thayer's second definition of holy. Thayer's second definition says to set apart for God, to be, as it were, exclusively His. And so what I would suggest is what you have in the Greek word is essentially the same thing that you have in the Hebrew word in the Old Testament. Saints, holy ones, are people who are set apart, separated for God. Set apart for God, as Evans says, they are a separated community. And so, again, with the Greek word, I'm going to boil it down to the idea of being separate, being separated, being distinct. And I'll come back and have more to say about that as we go on through the lesson. I'm going to just touch on a couple of things about how the word holiness is used in the Old Testament. Primarily, we'll focus our attention on how the word is used in the book of Leviticus, because that's where the word most often appears in the Old Testament. But the first time that the word appears in the Old Testament is in Genesis chapter 2. In the creation account, where it talks about God resting on the seventh day, and he made that day, Moses says, he made that day holy. And when you think about how I've defined the term, at least, boiling it down to separation, that makes perfect sense. When God created the world and set up time, there are 7 days in a week. The seventh day is different. The seventh day is a separate day. There's something distinct about it. There's something different about it. That day was to be set apart for God. Now, the idea of people setting aside that day for God doesn't reappear again until Israel is at Mount Sinai, until we get to the book of Leviticus. I don't know if you've ever had discussions with Seventh-day Adventists or people who were, you know, the idea of worshiping God still on Saturday, worshiping God still on the seventh day. One of the arguments they'll make is, well, that was instituted by God in creation. And it's true that that's the first time that that's mentioned. But there's no reference, there's no evidence, there's no indication that God ever instructed people to make that day holy. He set it aside as holy when he made the day. He called it holy. But the first time that he ever tells people, and it's the people at Mount Sinai, the first time that he ever tells people, the Jews, the Israelites, to make that day a holy day is at Mount Sinai. The place where God is present is holy. We were talking between the last presentation and the beginning of mine, and the comment was made when we're talking about the subject that Kevin was talking about. That we need to take our shoes off. We're walking on holy ground. We're standing on holy ground. That is definitely so. It is such a deep subject. There's so much about it to comprehend, so much about God's mercy and God's love and God's grace and God's plan, that we are indeed on holy ground. Well, we get that expression from Exodus chapter 3, where God says to Moses, take off your shoes because you are on holy ground. And so the place where God is said to be holy. I have a number of things in the outline that I'm not going to spend time to talk about in this presentation. But it's significant that after Sinai, when the Israelites moved around from place to place and they set up the camp, unholy things were not allowed to be in the camp. Certain things had to be carried outside the camp. Why? Because that ground was holy ground. That's where the tabernacle was built. That's where the presence of God was. And so human excrement had to be, and provisions had to be made to carry that outside the camp. The leftovers from the sacrifices were to be carried outside the camp. They weren't to be left in the presence of the camp. Why? Because that's where God was. And that was considered to be holy ground. And you have expressions like this that appear many times in the Old Testament. This is just one example in Isaiah chapter 43 and verse 3, where God is called the Holy One of Israel. And that's extremely important when we're talking about holiness, or when we're thinking about holiness. And what is the significance of holiness? It all starts with the fact that God is holy. And we'll see that in just a minute when we get into specifically some of the things in the book of Leviticus. When God says, be holy to the Israelites, he says to them, be holy because I am holy. And so it begins with, or it starts with, the holiness of God. And so he refers to himself, and the prophets refer to him in language like this many times in the Old Testament, that God is the Holy One of Israel. Just very briefly, because we're going to talk about this in more detail in another lecture, but holiness is, again, as we've already mentioned, very prominent subject, very prominent topic in the New Testament. The word doesn't appear in 1 Corinthians 6, but our bodies are said to be a temple of the Holy Spirit. Very similar to the concept of the camp of the Israelites being a place of holiness, and unholy things were not to be a part of that. The separation from the things which contaminate, what fellowship has holiness, God, with, and the things that are listed in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, sexual holiness and purity. Ephesians chapter 5, more warnings about the importance of being sexually pure. And then a lot of teaching about holiness is found in the writings of Peter. Peter very clearly references the book of Leviticus in a number of things that he says, and not just quoting from it, but making some of the same applications about the importance of God's people continuing to be holy. An example of the kind of holy life to which we are called, and I'll say more about this later on too, but that God, you know, that God wants us to be a holy people, and that entails certain things. In Hebrews chapter 12, the admonition, the correction, the discipline that comes with holiness or is part of living a holy life. The admonition in Revelation chapter 22 and verse 11 to continue in holiness. Again, the theme of holiness that is developed in such detail in the book of Leviticus runs throughout the New Testament from beginning to end. Holiness was not just something that to which the Israelites were called. It's something to which God's people are called. And so we're talking about the book of Leviticus, and I remember how excited I was when Kevin first revealed to me that we were going to talk about Leviticus. Again, I came to a deep and detailed study of the book of Leviticus way too late in life. I wish I'd started trying to absorb the teaching of this book a lot sooner than I did. But I just appreciate so much that we're using this kind of forum to talk about the book of Leviticus. And again, Gordon Wenham's commentary is outstanding. I don't think I could overemphasize or overstate what a good job it is for a commentary. What a good job that Wenham does in breaking down the book. But he says early on, "Be holy, for I am holy," could be termed the motto of Leviticus. Certainly, holy, clean, unclean, and cognate words are among the most common in the book. And later on he says, well, this is a footnote on the same page, but a footnote to that, the term holy and its cognate terms, sanctify, holiness, occur 152 times in Leviticus, and that's about 20% of the total occurrences in the Old Testament. A fifth of the usage of that word or its forms in the Old Testament of the 39 books appears in one book, and that's in the book of Leviticus. I want to talk about and spend a few minutes thinking about what Warren Wiersbe calls the holiness code. Starting in Leviticus chapter 11, and of course in Leviticus chapter 10, by the time you get up to Leviticus chapter 10, you have the priesthood set in place. Aaron is anointed as the priest, and the garments are put on him. And his two sons are anointed as priests with him, and the garments are put on them. And then, of course, Nadab and Abihu offer strange fire. Their bodies are destroyed by fire, but the garments aren't damaged or destroyed. The garments are picked up and put on two other sons of Aaron. And so going up to Leviticus chapter 10, you have all of those things. And the sacrifices that were associated with the, you know, all of that taking place. But in Leviticus chapter 11, starting in Leviticus chapter 11, you start to have very detailed instructions about holiness. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. And I was really confirmed in this after I had a chance a few weeks ago to look at Alan's outline, or Kevin's outline, because so much of the So much of the holiness code involves the sacrifices and the details of the sacrifices that are being offered. But what I want to do, just briefly look at, kind of in capsule form, look at Leviticus chapters 11 through 22. And what I want you to be thinking about as we go down through all of this is that by the time we're going to start in Leviticus 11, by the time we get to Leviticus chapter 2, there won't be any area, there won't be any aspect of the Israelites' daily life that is not touched on or covered. Everything, I mean, even things that wouldn't necessarily seem to be or wouldn't necessarily be associated with, you know, spiritual things like the offering of sacrifices, everything about their lives is going to be covered. So in chapter 11, you have instructions about separating from, certain kinds of creatures can be eaten and certain kind of creatures cannot be eaten. I don't remember. I meant to go back yesterday or after I got here today and look. Do some of y'all remember a book? I think it must have been in the 1970s, called None of These Diseases. And I don't remember the author of the book. And it was some material that Jeff did, some work that Jeff did on Leviticus that kind of reminded me that I had had a copy of that book at one time. And the author of that book, and if I'm misrepresenting what he said, you all correct me later. But basically the idea is that most of these food regulations, and even really most of these regulations, was God protecting their health? Was God keeping them healthy? And what I would suggest to you is that while that may have been kind of a side benefit of some of this, that doesn't really fly in terms of why God would give these regulations. Why are there some animals that you can eat and some animals that you couldn't eat? And especially in light of the fact that Peter had a vision in which there were animals of specifically animals that are named in Hebrew or in Leviticus chapter 11 that they were not allowed to eat. And Peter, of course, says, "Well, I've never eaten unclean things." And God rebukes him. God fusses at him. Why are you calling unclean what I've called clean? What changed about the human body being able to process bacteria? From before Peter and that vision to after Peter's. What I would suggest to you is, and again, it would be naive not to say that there were some residual benefits. I would want, if I were living there, I would be happy to know that the human waste was being taken outside the camp, for example. That would make me happy. There would definitely be some health benefits. What I'm suggesting to you is, in the broad context, that doesn't seem to be the reason why God gave these regulations. And we'll say more about that in just a few minutes. In chapter 12, instructions about remaining separated from contact with the sanctuary after childbirth. The amount of time if a male child is born, the amount of time if a female child is born, the sacrifices that had to be offered, but very specific instructions in Leviticus chapter 12 about that particular aspect. And again, as I mentioned a minute ago, what does bearing children or not bearing children have to do? In the broad scheme of things, we wouldn't necessarily associate that with some kind of a spiritual activity. And yet, very detailed, very specific instructions given. In chapter 13, instructions for people who have a rash or a swelling, infection, skin disease, sore, an itch, white spots, even mildew in clothing, those kinds of things. And you know, all of that is regulated in some way or another. In Leviticus chapter 14, a discussion of the law of leprous persons and how that is to be handled and how that is to be dealt with and what happens on the day of their cleansing. Maybe some of you have read something about this and know more about it than I've read, but my understanding is that, and I've seen pictures of people with a disease today that is called leprosy. For example, in the work that the Catholic nun who was called Mother Teresa did, my understanding is that that's not necessarily the same thing that leprosy would have been in the Old Testament. It was some kind of a skin disease, and it caused that person to be unclean. And while they were leprous, that not only could they not approach the sanctuary, they had to be separated from the whole camp. And they couldn't come back into the camp until they had been pronounced clean by the priest and gone through the various sacrifices and washings and cleansings in order to be allowed to come back in. In chapter 15, the separations that are necessary in the event of a bodily discharge. And these bodily discharges, many of these bodily discharges are just normal things. Again, they're not things that are necessarily associated with sinful conduct at all. They're just things that happen. And really, not comfortable saying much more about it than that. But the idea being, again, that this is not in your spiritual life, in your worship of God, here are some things that you have to do to be holy. Just in everyday living, there are things that you have to do in order to be considered holy. In chapter 16, detailed instructions about the Day of Atonement. I'm not going to say anything about it. Again, we have a whole lecture where we're going to be talking in some detail about the Day of Atonement. But those, and I think it is significant, though, Wenham thinks so. Warren Wiersbe, in his commentary, and a number of others think so, that there is some significance to the fact that these instructions about the Day of Atonement are right in the middle of the book. You know, that they're right in the middle, that all these other things surround the instructions about the Day of Atonement. You have some, in chapter 17, some various and sundry commandments about separation or being holy. Chapter 18, some more detailed instructions about sexual purity and sexual holiness. And incidentally, those some of the things, we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, but you know, when you talk, a number of things like homosexuality are discussed in the book of Leviticus. And so, you know, detailed instructions about those kinds of things, and that any kind of a sexual relationship outside of the marriage relationship between a husband and a wife would make someone unholy or make someone unclean. In chapter 19, miscellaneous laws of separation, beginning with the admonition, "Be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." And again, that's been impressive to me in my study of the book of Leviticus, is it's not just God saying, "Be holy," which would be plenty. That would be enough. But it's God over and over and over again saying, "Be holy, for I am holy." And so he identifies our holiness, the reason for our holiness, with the fact that he's holy as well. In chapter 20, you have instructions regarding separation, instructions regarding the worship of Molech, offering children in the fire to Molech, mediums, necromancers, fortune tellers, those kinds of things. All of that is considered by God to be unholy. And then in chapters 21 and 22, this section that Wiersbe calls the Holiness Code closes with the giving of specific instructions for the priests in their dress, conduct, and work as priest, along with some additional miscellaneous instructions. Now, again, I go into more detail about some of those things in the outline, but the point that I want to make, and that I think is really the important point about this Holiness Code, is that what God pauses to do in the book of Leviticus is he pauses to tell his people, when you take possession of the promised land, it's going to be clear that there's something different about you than all of the other people, all of the other nations. I am holy, God says. You're going to run into, they already had encountered, undoubtedly, during the time in Egypt, they had encountered a number of gods. But God is the one God. God is holy. There's something different about God, Yahweh, than any of the Egyptian gods. There's something different about God than any of the gods. And you don't misunderstand that what I'm saying or what I'm implying is that there's any validity to those gods. But something distinguishes God, the real God, the one God, from all of those other things that call themselves God. You go back to the creation of time. And in making time, I'm going to make a week composed of 7 days. But one day is going to be different. There's going to be something distinct. There's going to be something different about that day. And it will be clearly different. It will be clearly distinct. And then you look at all the things about which Moses talks, or God talks to Moses about in Leviticus chapters 11 through 22. And in essence, what you have is God saying to the Israelites, you as a people, you as a nation, are going to be different than any other people. You're going to be different than any other nation. And you're going to be different in a way that is easily seen, clearly distinguishable. I have no problem in my mind, picturing the questions that the Canaanites would have had, or that other peoples from some of the surrounding nations would have had. Why do you dress that way? You know, why do you eat the things that you eat? Why don't you eat the things that you don't eat? What is the difference? That God wanted them to be clearly and obviously different or distinct. Wenham says, "This survey of the use of the terms for holiness, cleanness, and uncleanness has demonstrated the importance of these ideas for understanding Leviticus. I have suggested that cleanness is the natural state of most creatures. Holiness is a state of grace to which men are called by God, and it is attained through obeying the law and carrying out rituals such as sacrifice. Uncleanness is a substandard condition to which men descend through bodily processes and sin. Every Israelite had a duty to seek release from uncleanness through washing and sacrificing, because uncleanness was quite incompatible with the holiness of the covenant people." And so, God says to the Israelites, you're going to be separate. You're going to be different. And the way you're going to be different is virtually everything about your lives. How you dress, how you talk, the things that you eat, the things that you don't eat, how you deal with just normal bodily processes, all of those things are going to be different than what you have encountered or what you see going on in the world around you. God's people can and must live like God. God, not man, is our standard of living. And again, Wenham, New Testament theology makes full use of the idea of holiness. All Christians are holy, saints in most English translations. Peter urges his readers to make the motto of Leviticus their own: be holy, for I am holy, 1 Peter 1:16. The mention of God is a theme that unites the ethics of the Old and the New Testament. And I think that's right. And what I want to do, and really, this is not exactly what Kevin asked me to do, but I hope I don't stray too far away from what you wanted. In terms of making this practical, I want us to think for a few minutes about personal holiness in the 21st century. And if I'm wrong about how I have filtered down holiness to separation or distinction, then I'm sure y'all will let me know. I have no doubt about that, as a matter of fact. But if I'm right, then how do we manifest holiness in the 21st century? And I want to suggest several things to you. In the Bible, to be holy is to be separate or distinct or different. And a lot of us in the room, not everybody, but a lot of us in the room, and myself in that list, as one of the older, and boy, that pains me to say that, but as one of the older participants in the SITS conference, I grew up in a time and a place in history when being holy didn't present a really severe challenge. And to illustrate that, just kind of look around the room. Look at how we're dressed. And we're not all dressed exactly the same. But none of us are dressed in such a way that when you parked your car and walked down the hill, heads were turning. And no, none of you are handsome enough that happened anyway. But, you know, the way you're dressed, we're all dressed modestly. I think we would all agree that we're dressed modestly. But it didn't require any great sacrifice. It didn't require any great challenge on our part. But what I want to suggest to you in the final few minutes of my time is that that's changing. And I think it's changing quickly. And the reason it's changing, I think, is because of what has come to be known as postmodernism. And I would almost suggest, go out on a limb, I think I will just go out on the limb and suggest that there haven't been, in our lifetime, there certainly hasn't been any greater danger to holiness than postmodernism and all of the things that postmodernism represents. By the way, two sources that have been recommended to me. Phil Sanders' book I've read, as a matter of fact, I've read it more than once, called Adrift, Postmodernism and the Church. I would highly recommend that book to you if you haven't read it. It's a little old, I saw something that Sanders wrote where he says it needs some revision, it needs some updating. Still, though, very helpful. D.A. Carson's book, The Intolerance of Tolerance. I haven't read it all the way through yet. It's been highly recommended to me. But I've read the introduction. I've read part of the first chapter. Carson does a great job of defining postmodernism and talking about postmodernism. What is postmodernism and what does it have to do with holiness? Wayne Jackson, and this is an article that I found online in the Christian Courier in October of 2000. Jackson says postmodernism is essentially a mid to late 20th century theory of knowledge which states that there is not real knowledge, at least not in the objective external world that can be perceived by the human senses. And then Jackson goes on to define or to describe some of the characteristics of postmodernism. There are no absolutes. How could that be true, by the way, if there are no absolutes? But common sense doesn't play much of a role in the mind of postmodernists. All beliefs are equally valid, and so therefore criticism of any belief is forbidden, since all beliefs are equally valid. Jackson talks about deconstruction, and deconstruction is the idea that you don't trust any universal discourse, including the Bible. We can't take what was written, and you'll hear statements like this. And actually, it scares me that I've heard brethren say things like this, that you can't really take what was written to people 2,000 years ago and apply it to our time. When we read the New Testament, we're just reading other people's mail. Those kinds of things, which is a manifestation, I think, of postmodernism. And history may be rewritten to meet the needs of any particular group. We've had to fight some battles, and we're still fighting some battles in order to maintain holiness. Some of this comes from the material that Gary submitted, that Gary Fisher submitted. You'll find it on the page of the supplemental material. But in the field of entertainment, we've all preached sermons about, what television programs are you watching? What kind of movies, R-rated movies? What violence in the movies? What kind of movies are you going to see? Music, shows, the internet, video games. I mean, we've had to fight those battles, and we fought them on the field, whether we use the term or not. We fought those battles on the field of holiness. All my friends are going to that movie. Well, there's something different about you. All my friends watch that television show. Well, you're a Christian. There's something different about you. All my friends dress that way. Well, there's something different about you. And so whether we use the word holiness or not, we were fighting those battles on the battleground of holiness. And we were trying to teach our children, and we were trying to remind ourselves that God expects us to be distinct. He expects us to be different. Our speech, when you on the job, or when you at school, or when you standing around the backyard with a bunch of neighbors and they're using filthy language and you don't, and you even show displeasure with the kind of language they're using, you're fighting that battle on the ground of holiness. How you conduct yourself with the opposite gender, pornography, which Gary has done some outstanding work on, by the way, if you're not familiar with some of the work that Gary's done and prepared, and the efforts that he's made to help young people and young men especially, I would commend it to you. But we fight those battles on the battleground, on the field of holiness. But even within, how much time have we got? Yeah, 11 minutes. In the work and the worship of the local church, we fought instrumental music. We're fighting on the battleground of holiness. What does God say? What is the kind of music that God wants? Monetary support of human institutions, positive versus negative preaching, formal versus informal services, and formal versus informal attire. We've dealt with those issues, and we're going to continue, by the way. I don't mean to trivialize any of that. We're going to continue to fight these battles. And as long as there are people, and as long as there's sin, as long as Satan is still working effectively in the world, we're going to have to keep fighting these battles. They're not ever going to be won until we get to the place where we're trying to go. But what I would suggest to you is that we are moving on to some battlegrounds now, and that are going to seriously challenge us, I think. And we're going to have to be prepared to fight these battles. For example, is there a standard of absolute truth? You know, is the Bible God's final revelation to human beings? Can it be trusted? You know, you expected those questions from the Mormons who knocked on your door in years gone by. If you're like me, you were stunned when brethren started asking those questions. That, well, really, can we trust the Bible? Isn't it true that there are different Greek texts upon which the English translations are based? And isn't it true that the scholars, didn't we see some of that in Kevin's presentation? That scholars don't always agree about what does this word mean or how does this particular principle apply? That's what I'm suggesting to you is that's postmodernism. Latter-day revelation, more and more in Bowling Green, Kentucky, Not exclusively, but primarily among the college students. We are hearing stories of Latter-day Revelation. I had a discussion with a young lady last week who, and I'm not going to quote her exactly, and I'm certainly not going to reveal her identity, but fundamentally what she said was this, that When she's talking with someone about God, God tells her what to say. She can hear it. You know, she empties her mind, and God just puts the words there, and she can hear the voice. And all she has to do then is she just has to repeat what God. This is a young lady who was raised by parents who were Christians, and brought up listening to the preaching of faithful, godly men all of her life. But we're hearing young people say, you know, I feel like, you know, God. And Jeremiah, I think it's Jeremiah 29:11, where God says to Jeremiah, I have plans for you, plans for your good and not for your evil. And so, you know, so that the young people will say things like, well, you know, we had a discussion, the elders at Eastside had a discussion with a young man. And, you know, as I was really wrestling with, I was accepted at Auburn and I was accepted at Western Kentucky and I didn't know what to do. And so I finally just decided to just let God will settle it. God will tell me. And God told me to go to Western Kentucky. Listen, I would have told him to go to Western Kentucky and not go to Auburn. But anyway, Latter-day Revelation, and that's a manifestation of postmodernism, that God is still revealing his will to people. Is homosexuality a sin? Or have we missed that in the scriptures? What about homosexual marriage? You know, what's the stand we're going to take? What are we going to do about homosexual marriage? Women in leadership roles in the local church. Is the New Testament message valid for Christians today? Are emotions a valid barometer of spirituality? I'm more spiritual than you because I get excited and I stand up and I wave my hands and I shuffle my feet. And that means that I'm spiritual. And you just sit there with a frown on your face and that means you're not spiritual. Well, are emotions a valid barometer of spirituality? Those are battles that we're going to be waging now. And, you know, when we think about this, we've been talking, Kentucky is going through the process of, and we're just a step or two away from it in Kentucky, of legalizing homosexual marriage. Actually, I guess legally, homosexual marriage has to be accepted. If you were married in another state and you come to Kentucky, that you have to be recognized as being married now. But legislation is working its way through the Kentucky House that has ample support to get passed, which would make Kentucky another one of those states where you could actually get married where homosexual marriages could be performed. How are we going to deal with that? How are we going to approach questions like that? And in point of fact, it can get kind of overwhelming. I mean, it can get really discouraging, really depressing. When you think about all of the things that are going on in the world, and when you think about how quickly, I mean, where we are now compared to where we were as a nation 10 years ago is alarming. But what if we choose to look at it like this? You know, we've been very blessed. We've been very fortunate. For the most part, most of us have grown up in a time and in a place where you could be holy. You could, and you could stand with God on issues like this, and nobody's ever going to give it a second thought. What happens when if somebody knows that you think homosexuality is a sin, it could cost you your freedom. It could cost you a fine. What happens when you refuse to perform a homosexual marriage? Or the couple in your local congregation that has a catering business refuses to cater a homosexual wedding? What happens? You know, well, we could wring our hands in despair. We could all get law degrees and pack the courts and pack the legislatures. Or maybe this. Blessed are the persecuted. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Maybe we could approach postmodernism with the idea that it has always been God's will for his people that they be holy and different and distinct. I haven't had that many opportunities in my lifetime. A few. None of them that ever cost me anything. Never cost me a job. You know, never cost me a family member. But I really suspect that if I live many more years, I'm going to be confronted with more and more opportunities to show God that I understand what holiness is and that I'm willing to be counted as different, that I'm willing to be counted as distinct. And maybe we thank God for the opportunities that he's giving us and that he's going to be giving us to demonstrate holiness. Your position on homosexuality did not distinguish you from 80% of the citizens of the United States 25 years ago. Your position, I'm assuming your position on homosexuality around this table, now it distinguishes you from more than half of the citizens of the United States. And those polls are not just polls that are being conducted by liberal media outlets. They are scientific polls that are being conducted by disinterested organizations. Clearly the tide has turned. And so on your job, in your communities, with your family, when I think about my children, which really is a bigger concern to me, and my grandchildren, I could just worry myself to death about the kind of world that my children are going to inherit from me and that my grandchildren are going to inherit from me, and then I go back and read Leviticus. And I tell my sons to read Leviticus, and I tell my sons to read my grandchildren Leviticus. Don't stop teaching them about Moses and the Ark. I'm not the only one who's ever done that in the pulpit, am I? Anybody else ever? Just me? Did you even catch what I said? Maybe there's the real question. Don't stop telling my grandchildren those stories, but read them Leviticus. And teach them that God is holy. And God and that means God is different. There is no God like God. There is nothing to compare to God. God intends for his people to be holy too. And if my children learn that lesson and if my grandchildren learn that lesson, whatever happens in society, they'll be fine. And we'll be together in heaven one day. So thank you, Kevin, for giving me the opportunity to get up on my soapbox and present that. And I hope it wasn't too foreign from what you wanted presented from the book of Leviticus. But again, what a great book it is, and let's make it more and more a part of our preaching, more and more a part of the work that we're doing in trying to share God's word with people. Thank you all very much.